This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
Good afternoon. We have some movies to discuss. Mark's already established his presence with us.
Have I?
With the fine interrogation with Steve Earle when he was here.
Oh, OK. That was establishing my presence.
I think
is that like building the brand?
That was the... Exactly.
OK.
Nothing wrong with that either. And Charlie Fink is here, lead singer of Noah and the Whale. Got a new movie out on DVD. First Days of Spring goes with the album. Is it a movie? I mean, it's 45 minutes, isn't it?
So, yeah, nearly 50 minutes.
Nearer to 50.
It's a short.
Well, of Time in the City is only 65, and that's a feature. Yeah. So it's a long short. It's a novella of a film.
It's a middle.
Yeah.
A medium.
So why have you done a movie to go with the album, Charlie?
Well, the inspiration for this project lies primarily in the music. And it's, for me, it's about the nature of what an album is. And I feel the way music is consumed currently, with the availability of it and the digital presence of it, is that it's rarely consumed as a whole, an album, that it's taken in parts and consumed as individual songs. And I, you know, not that I think that that's necessarily a bad thing. I love, you know, a great pop song as much as anyone else, and I think that's a great thing as well. But I find I often have particularly exaggerated experiences when you take an album in full. You listen from the beginning to the end and you take that journey with it, you know. And so this is essentially about creating a sort of submersive environment where you're listening to the album in full and you're reacting to it and you're kind of putting it in context of this film. That's the primary experience.
Is this a good way to go, Mark, of making people listen to the whole thing?
Well, people, you know, there have always been filmmakers and musicians who've worked together. There have always been albums that are kind of, you know, produced with visuals. There's a famous story, isn't there, that apparently you're able to watch Dark Side of the Moon against The Wizard of Oz if you start it on the light. Well, I've never actually tried doing that, but it's meant to be the case. I mean, it's quite a complicated film. It's three different times. I mean, I confess I had to watch it twice before I quite figured this out. It's three different sections of a guy's life. You see this character, it's Ethan. Mm-hmm. You might want to explain this, in fact, who you see at different points in his life. There's a young, there's a kind of middle, and there's an older one. And there's a sort of a theme running through all of them, but it's not linear. It's what's the word? Elliptical. Explain that to us.
Yeah, I mean, I guess one of the things I was nervous about making a film with an album is that you're sort of invading on someone's relationship with it. You know,
I mean, as soon as you put visuals on it,
exactly. Yeah. Like, I find probably more than any other art, music is something you can project onto, you know, and you can relate to and put it in your own life. And so I didn't want to make a story that was really forceful and blatant. You know, I wanted a story that was kind of, as you said, that you might take two watches to
understand. No, I did. I'm sorry. But it didn't matter. I mean, I enjoyed it the first time around anyway. It was only the second time around that I actually kind of got, oh, fine, they are all exactly the same character in different parts of his life, but that may just be me being dim.
But that's the thing. I mean, I think it's about the process of watching it as much as anything else, you know, about the process of going through it with the album. And it's obviously rewarding, I think, to understand the narrative. But at the same time, I think you can experience it without knowing the narrative, even and just having elements of the story, and it could still work. You
know? Now, Noah and the Whale was supported by the Dodge Brothers. How does this musical collaboration work out?
Well, it's actually funny. This is... today, it kind of reminds me of that experience that coming on the radio after Steve Earle, coming onto the stage after the Dodge Brothers.
Let's get this into some perspective. They were really kind to us. I mean, it was really nice. They got in touch with us and said we're playing, because this was the album launch at the Roundhouse, which they turned into a sort of like a cafe. They're all these, you know what the Roundhouse is like, right? I mean, I grew up in the Roundhouse, you know, standing next to
the Roundhouse in Camden in North London.
In Camden in North London. And it was the punk venue. It's where I saw Alberto Zelos Trios Paranoias do snuff rock. It's where I stood next to Elvis Costello in the toilets. It's where I had almost had my eardrums melted off by the Damned and Motorhead. And there we were in this incredibly cultured environment with these tables, with these little pools of light on them. And they were very, very kind because they said, do you want to play? It was a lifelong ambition to play at the Roundhouse. And then we did it. They were really nice. Although I have to say, I do think that perhaps some of the people who are tuned into the the sensitivity of what Noah and the Whale do were perhaps slightly baffled by a bunch of people playing skiffle songs about people getting drunk and shooting each other. But it was very, very kind and we enjoyed it enormously.
Was there anyone left?
Are you a great debt?
But by the time they'd finished, was there an audience there?
Yeah, there's an audience raring to go. Yeah, certainly.
Yeah, yeah. By the time the skiffle band got off, the audience were raring to go.
So the album and the film are both called The First Days of Spring. It's new from Noah and the Whale. We're going to do a box office top 10. You might be able to help out Mark, because he still hasn't caught up. Just before we get
But then there's been lots of films out, and I've been doing lots of stuff.
Right, OK, fair enough. Before we get to the box office top 10, news in the last couple of minutes, getting reports from the Reuters news agency and others that the US Coast Guard has fired on a suspicious boat in the Potomac River. This is in central Washington, D.C. High security, of course, being the 9/11 anniversary memorial ceremonies going on. You heard from President Obama just a few moments ago. They were being held nearby at the Pentagon. But it's Reuters reporting that the U.S. Coast Guard firing on a suspicious boat in the Potomac River in central Washington. If we get more details, we'll obviously bring that to you. So it's 3:13. Fish Tank is out this week. Adventureland, Dorian Gray, Sorority. Is it Row or Row?
Sorority Row, it's as in the play. House on Sorority.
Well, I don't know.
Did you
know.
Really think it was there was a film called Sorority Row?
It was a row about sorority.
That's like the Texas Chainsaw Mascara.
Yes. I just think there might have been a row about who was sorority.
I would love to see you walking out of a cinema going, I've been completely... I came to see a film called Sorority Row, and it's not that at all.
But there's a bit of shouting in there.
There is, yes.
So we'll do box office top 10. Charlie, you can chip in.
Sure.
Because there's still a couple
three
of
three films which Mark hasn't seen.
Broken Embrace, Funny People. Or
Broken Embraces. Seen it, but I know it's called Broken Embraces, and every week it comes up as Broken Embrace.
Broken Embraces. At 10.
I haven't seen
it. I haven't seen it either. Oh,
it's useless.
But it's the Pedro Almodovar film. I'm sure it's very good.
Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince at 9. Still an awful lot of correspondence coming in about this. Let me just pick one. Dear Messrs. Rodolphus and Rabaston Lestrange.
Okay. That's, what's it, isn't it?
It is, what's it. What everyone appears to be missing about the unfortunate incident, or the unhappy event, or the teary moment, or the leap of faith, or the reflection on manners, and so on, in Harry Potter 6, is that the problem, the thing that renders the scene broken, is not Harry trusting Snape, but Snape not informing his cohorts that the Potter boy is there. The Dark Lord wants Harry out of the picture. This is the perfect opportunity to either kidnap or kill him. So however hard it may seem to believe in the wake of said unfortunate incident, Snape's choice not to expose Harry to the wrath of the Death Eaters seems to demonstrate his true allegiance, rendering the whole twist a bit pointless. Yours in Potter, Owen Edwards, Library Award winner, Stanborough School Sixth Form College graduating class of 2006.
It's one of those things that
I might have just given the ending.
Yeah, if that wasn't quite so impenetrable, has that just given away the ending? But it's okay because we all got lost in the subclause.
Anyway, G-Force is at 8,
which is fine, but proves you don't need 3D.
Time Traveller's Wife with. Did you see G-Force, by the way?
I have not seen.
Seen G-Force. Time Traveller?
No.
Okay, which ones have you seen? Just so I don't embarrass myself.
The next one I've seen is Funny People,
which I haven't seen. So we'll let Charlie.
Time Traveller's Wife at 7.
You know, a pretty solid bash at a clearly unfilmable novel. Eric Banner gives it his best. Despite all the correspondence, and thank you for that, the film does not clarify the issue that he can only travel forward in time after he meets the woman who he's always been going to marry for the first time. And I know it's explained in the book, but a book and a film are a different thing. That said, I thought it was much better than I'd expected. It's interesting that it's done as well as it has.
Aliens in the Attic, number 6.
I thought we were doing Funny People next. No, Aliens in the Attic, fine. Well, you know,
we'll get to, but 5 comes after 6. Funny People at 5.
Yes.
Charlie fan.
Charlie.
Well, you're not a particularly big fan of Judd Apatow,
No.
I don't think this is going to change your mind. I always often hear you talk about actors who you find frustrating because you don't feel they're using their talents to good use.
Perhaps. Yes.
And I personally feel Adam Sandler is probably an extreme example of that because he's an incredibly talented actor and I love Punch Drunk Love.
Yes.
But I'm constantly frustrated by him.
Well, listen, can I say on that issue, see, the Punch Drunk Love thing is the problem with Adam Sandler, because Punch Drunk Love is a fantastic film. It is near as damn it flawless. It is, to the best of my memory, 86 minutes long, which is almost a perfect time. And Sandler is so good in it that it makes all the rubbish he does all the more unforgivable. The problem is, I struggle to think of other movies in which he comes even close. I mean, even the post 9/11 movie that he made, the name of which now it was called that, named after that Who song. What's the Who song? What? They had to. There's the Adam Sandler post 9/11 movie that's named after a Who song. They had to change the title in order to make it make grammatic sense. In which he plays somebody who lost somebody in 9/11, and it's a very sort of it's a sense of drama. It's obviously him attempting to get back to that serious acting, but I don't think in that he comes anywhere close to the brilliance of Punch Drunk Love. And because Punch Drunk Love was so great, doing stuff that isn't it just becomes all the more unacceptable.
Now, Inglourious Ahem is at number 4, and I just want to read this. You've seen it, Charlie, haven't you? So I just want to read this just because it has a really good point. It's my favourite email about this Vainglorious Dastards film. Dear Barry and Robin, this is from Gareth, MSc in Bioinformatics, certified to taste the conductivity of water to within 5.0 units. Thank you.
I'll just say quickly, rain over me.
Have just watched the latest Tarantino endurance test. And I just wanted to say thanks, Mark, for being spot on yet again, even if it means he's a fascist, according to the fellow you mentioned last
week. That's right,
after an interesting start, irritable barristers descended into the usual type of unnecessarily convoluted plot nonsense that Quent has been treating us to of late and kept on going for what seemed like hours. Here is the killer point.
Mm-hmm.
Also, says Gareth, any film that gives one a vague sense of disappointment when Hitler gets shot, as a result of the director's decision to play fast and loose with historical facts is surely not a good thing. And that's so right, isn't it? And it never occurred to me. So, Gareth, it's the email of the day. I think that's absolutely fair point. Charlie, what do you make of it?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of agree what you said before, that there are some really remarkable scenes in there, you know, but it doesn't link up. I think that's fair.
And I think Michael Fassbender is really, really good in it. Michael Fassbender, because he's in Fish Tank, which comes out this week. There are individual things in it that are good, but once again, it's a case of the things that are right make the things that are wrong so much more unbearable.
Number 3 is 500 Days of Summer. Tim on this saying, did you recognise the background music in the clip that you played last week? It was France's First Lady, Carla Bruni Sarkozy, singing Quelque Madi.
I didn't recognise it because I haven't listened to a Carla Bruni Sarkozy record. Have you listened to any of her stuff?
Not really.
No, fine.
I think
that's
you'd
good.
Like it.
Really?
Yeah.
Check it out.
Meanwhile, Zooey Deschanel. Ooh, Zooey Deschanel. In the background. Oh, he's not holding what I need. But that's what it's like. And then this sort of stentorian voiceover goes, it was on that day that he realised that love was not for him.
You've missed the talent here, Charlie. Next time you've got a film to put together, the voiceover artist should be Mark. You can do so many voices.
I see that now, yeah.
New. Noah and the Whale. And incidentally, we have to talk about that film. Because you must be named after Noah Baumbach's Squid and the Whale.
That's right.
Yeah. Need to change that very fast. Because, you know, much as I like you and much as I like your music, the Squid and the Whale is so full of itself.
Well,
justify yourself then, Charlie. Come
Charlie
on the
and
show.
The Exorcists. Maybe.
Yeah, well, that would have been fine.
Final Destination thing.
I haven't seen it either, but I've no real intention to see it.
District 9 is at number 1, described by Alan Davis as prawns eating whiskers, which is pretty good.
Is this Alan Davis, the comedian,
yes,
who the very sound of my voice makes him turn off the radio?
Yes.
So
yes.
He's switched off by now, unfortunately. No, it's District 9's really good. I mean, it's a good gribbly monster movie that's actually about something, and it has a smart political sensibility, and it's got a very good central performance by that guy who plays Lawrence Vander, whatever his name is. And apparently he's quite well known as a TV star, although I'd never seen him before, and I think it's really good. Have you seen it?
Yeah, I enjoyed it a lot.
It's good, isn't it? I mean, yeah. You know, it satisfies everything. You feel politically satisfied, and also you get to see gribbly monsters shooting each other.
What more could you want? Vincent, do you feel politically satisfied? I'm not sure
I
what
do.
That means.
Oh, I do feel politically
you mean it was
satisfied.
It was
yes.
About something.
I won't
is
get fooled
mean?
Again, but I am politically satisfied. That's what Mick Jagger said. Instantly, can I mention very passingly, because that just reminded
hang
me,
on,
Gimme
no.
Shelter is now out on DVD, and this is the greatest rock doc of all time, as you and I discovered on The Culture. Have you ever seen this?
I haven't. I want to, though. Oh, wow.
Vincent Pickering in Leeds, dear peace and love. While watching the rather excellent District 9 with my partner last week during the final action sequence, we were rather taken aback when a pig was used as a weapon. Funny in context as it was. My question to Dr. K is this. Have there been any other pig-based weaponry used in films before District 9?
No, but there is that moment in Monty Python and the Holy Grail, Fetche la Vache.
The closest we could think of was the cow used in a catapult
Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
So, anyone else think of any pig-based weaponry?
There is a scene in Motel Hell in which two guys have a chainsaw battle and one of them is wearing a pig's head during it. And there's the thing in The Shining when the kid goes around the door and sees the guy with the pig's head mask on, but that's not the same as using a pig as a weapon.
This from Damien. I went to see District 9 last night after being bombarded with how good it is, meant to be, and different from all other science fiction films. When it finished, I turned to my girlfriend and apologised. For such a relatively short film, I haven't been so bored since The Dark Knight. If you've seen Black Hawk Down, The Fly and Rocket Man and any buddy movie, put them together, then you've already seen this film. Boring, long shootouts, characters that no one cares about. What was so different to the usual dross that is turned out?
I don't agree, but I didn't say it was different. In fact, I remember listing the movies that it was like. And in fact, I got a text from somebody or a you know, somebody sent in a letter, an electronic mail,
pigeon,
or however you call it, saying that they were very cross because I said it, you know, it alludes to They Live and therefore Body Snatchers, because They Live is effectively a remake of Body Snatchers. And they said, it's not a remake. How dare you? It's John Carpenter's best film. Yeah, but it's essentially Body Snatchers.
So your comment on District 9 then, Charlie, finally, give us your thoughts on that.
I did enjoy it. The only thing I find confusing is one of these films that's presented by, you know, it's like a long...
Presented by Peter Jackson.
I don't really understand that phenomenon, because it was obviously The Orphanage as well was the same.
Well, that's The Orphanage, which was Guillermo del Toro presented it. I mean, he was very much a kind of guiding light for it. Yeah. And in fact, I think the funny thing was that when they played The Orphanage first at Cannes, Guillermo was there and... Juan Antonio Bayona, the director, was there as well. And I think an awful lot of people were thinking of it as more as a Guillermo del Toro film. I think there are things in District 9 that look very Peter Jackson-y. I mean, have you seen that film Bad Taste, the first film you met with? I think there are things in District 9 that are clearly influenced by Bad Taste. I think the central character in District 9 owes a certain debt to Derek in Bad Taste. Now, I'm a Derek and Derek's don't run. And incidentally, that's a Kiwi accent, not an Australian accent, as we have been corrected.
I did try to correct you as you said it, but you were in a tirade.
Anyway, look,
we're well adrift of where we should be. Charlie, thank you very much indeed for
coming in. Charlie's staying for Adventureland because he's seen it, which is the first film we're reviewing.
Charlie, thanks very much indeed for coming in. Stay for Adventureland, which is the first film that we're getting to in just a moment. But Noah and the Whale, First Days of Spring is the album. And it's the film as well. Anyway, don't need to mention that. Let's do Nick Dunkoff somewhat later than advertised. But don't go anywhere, because Charlie is staying with Mark for Adventureland's first movie we're getting to in just a moment. After Nick Dunkoff.
OK. Northbound M1. There was an accident between Junction... Oh, 5 hour travel.
Mentioned a while back that there had been reports that the Coast Guard had fired on a suspicious boat on the Potomac River. In Washington, that was according to the Reuters news agency. ABC in America reporting that the Coast Guard is saying that the incident on the Potomac River is a training exercise. One heck of a day for a training exercise, but that's the latest as we have it. So, David, on this, Willow the Magician turns everyone into pigs and counts as a weapon. So does that count as
okay,
a pig?
Okay, yes,
pig-based
that, I think
weapon?
That is. That does count, yes.
And what about John and Kim Bolton, Carrie? Because all the blood in
is-
there...
Yeah, okay.
Does that come from a pig?
Stretching a point. You know, the thing that I want to see revived is Carrie the Musical. That was after which there was the phrase, not since Carrie the Musical.
Well, you want it back?
Yeah, I never saw it. They only have sort of played for a very brief period of time before it was laughed at. You know, out of it. I think nowadays it would actually go down quite well. If Mamma Mia is the huge hit that it is, I think Carrie the Musical needs a revival.
Some more District 9 correspondence. Lots of it, because lots of people want to join in that. But first of all, while Charlie's with us, let's talk about Adventureland, because you're staying with us for that.
Okay, so Adventureland...
Is that the first film we're doing today?
We're going to do Adventureland first. And do you want to set it up, Charlie? Or would you like me to do that? Why don't you tell the audience what Adventureland is about before we zoom into a clip?
Adventureland, I guess, is the... As far as I understand, it's a fairly biographical movie by the director, Greg Mottola, about a summer he spent working in Adventureland, which is a fairground, and he meets Kristen Stewart, well, the character does, and a romance ensues... And I'm nervous about giving away anything too much.
So. No, I don't think you're giving away too much to say that it's a young rabbit. So yeah, basically, he wants to go to college. His dad loses his job. He doesn't have the money. He has to go and work a summer in Adventureland. Adventureland is a horrible play park where, you know, none of the rides work properly. But on the other hand, he does get to meet the woman who you would know best as the star of Twilight, who you said stood up at the premiere of Twilight and looked spectacularly unimpressed by the fact that she was just starring in this fantastic. And you actually said kind of thing in which you wanted to say, "Come on."
She came in, and it was a big moment because Twilight, clearly a big picture, a wonderful thing to star in, and she couldn't sell it for all the tea in China. She had absolutely no idea what to say about anything to anybody, and you're thinking, come on, this is your big moment, impress us.
But she did a lot of her moment. Anyway,
I'm really happy to be.
But so he falls for her. She's a bit of a shoegazer. He falls for her. And anyway, here's a clip of the movie. Here's a clip.
Hey, do you have an ice pick I can jam into my ears? I can't listen to this song again.
I don't, but...
Yes. Be cool with that.
Okay, thanks.
You had a date last night?
Oh, I wouldn't call it a date.
Not into M?
No, she's great. She's great. I don't know if I'm ready for a girlfriend yet. I'm kind of getting over a broken heart.
I hope you didn't tell her that, though.
Why?
You told her that, didn't you? James, no girl wants to hear about some other chick you're hard up for.
Right. They don't?
They don't. Look, I'm not saying never be vulnerable with a girl. Just saying, don't play that card first.
Wait, it's a card? Like a card?
There's a science to it. You're probably pretty good at science.
So that's Ryan Reynolds, I keep calling him Philippe, who was last seen in The Proposal, which is terrible. It's directed by Greg Mottola, who is from the Juddapatapatapatapatapatow stable, which is terrible. And it stars Jesse Eisenberg, who, of course, is in...
The Squid in the Whale.
Not Noah in the Whale, he's in The Squid in the Whale. I was going to say he's in Noah in the Whale. He plays bass, OK? And the film is really lovely. And I really like... And it was one of those things when you went in and my expectations were kind of low. And I was really charmed by it. I thought it had a genuine sense of the awkwardness of young love. I thought it was genuinely funny. It doesn't have any of that nonsensical Judd Apatow potty-mouthed teenage boy. You know, the fact is, teenage boys don't talk like the way the teenage boys do in Judd Apatow. The people who talk like that are Judd Apatow and the grown-ups who are, you know, permanently infantilised. But actually,
does he treat women properly? Are they all...
No, he does. He does. And that's the other thing, is that, in fact, the woman with whom he falls in love, M, who is playing the sort of, you know, the introverted, goth-like character with a darker side. If you saw, I don't know whether you saw Band Slam, in which Vanessa Hugeness from the High School Musical is meant to be the sort of dark introverted goth, and bless her, she's a lot of things, but dark introverted goth isn't one of them. But you do actually get the sense this time that there is an interesting character, and she's conflicted, and she's got another relationship which is going on, which you believe in, and you believe she's trapped in her situation, and it's not one of those movies about some annoying adolescent spotty oik boy just having this kind of obsession with a two-dimensional woman about whom, you know, all his friends make potty mouth references, but actually he's in love. It is in fact a film about two people, and the best thing I can say about it is it reminded me very slightly of one of my favourite films, which is a lovely 1970s movie called Jeremy. You ever seen that?
No.
It's a fantastic movie. Went out as a supporting feature with Breakheart Park.
I haven't seen it either.
No, well, it's lovely. I think
opinion.
You can get it on
Justin,
DVD.
Justin,
no, I've
seen
never seen it. No,
no one's seen
you'd
it.
You'd love it.
No.
It's because you're a smart guy. You'd love it.
Just
it's a really,
Charlie?
Really good film. Just, no, you know, a lot
Justin
of other people
would
love
like it.
And I now invite the listeners to text in and tell us that they have seen Jeremy and that I am right. It is an absolute charm. I thought Adventure
Can they text
was,
in and say you're wrong?
They can, but I mean, you know, why embarrass themselves on air? No, I mean, go ahead, you know, look silly, that's perfectly fine. I was really, really surprised by Adventureland. I thought the jokes were funny, I thought the characters were believable, I thought the way the plot played out, I don't know how autobiographical it may or may not be, but it had the ring of truth about it, and I thought all the stuff about setting it in a fairground, which of course is a prime spot for horror movies, that whole idea about, you know, fun fair and horror is very close together, was actually worked really well. Charlie?
No, I completely agree. I absolutely loved it. To be honest, I thought it was a film you weren't going to like. But I thoroughly enjoyed it. I watched it while we were on tour in America, and I got kind of obsessed with it. It really struck a chord with me. Yeah, I feel like I never had that kind of growing up experience that's in that film. And it feels very romantic. And I read about it, and the director does claim that it is a story from him. And I think Kristen Stewart is amazing. I think she's a fantastic actress.
Yeah, she's really good in it. But she's a classic case of one of those people who on screen is doing really good, but apparently off screen is a little bit lost. But that's perfectly fine. You ever seen Robert De Niro interviewed? It's like a piece of cardboard. He can barely string two words together if he hasn't got a script.
Yeah.
Charlie, it's very good of you to come in. Appreciate that. Thanks very much indeed. Unless you've seen all the other films, in which case, we're done.
I haven't seen the film, so...
But never prejudge my opinion on anything. So I really, really liked
it. Yeah, right, thanks. Noah and the Whale, the film and the album, The First Days of Spring. Charlie, really appreciate you coming in. Thanks very much. If I could say the word appreciate, that'd be very good. On the subject of District 9, this is Neil in Oxford. I was interested to hear Dr. Kay's review of District 9 in this week's podcast. But wonder what his take was on the criticism of the film as xenophobic and racist. This has to do primarily with the depiction of the Nigerians, who are said to reinforce negative stereotypes of Africans as criminal and primitive. Anyone who's seen the film will know that all the bad stuff pretty much comes from the Nigerian gangsters.
Well, that's actually not true.
Let me finish here.
Sorry.
Blomkamp has argued that the depiction is fair in that Nigerian gangs are indeed responsible for a significant amount of crime in South Africa. Critics have responded that since the film is set in an alternate reality, that's not sufficient justification for this portrayal. It's also true that essentially no humans are portrayed in a good light. I mean, it's certainly, yeah. It is certainly true that in South Africa, the Nigerians are behind a lot of the crime. What do you think?
I think that what I took away from that film was that the depiction of the central agency, which is almost entirely white, doing the moving them from one place to the other, were in fact the people that were in charge, and everybody else were under the cosh of that regime. It never occurred to me to think, oh, in fact, what you've got here is a racist depiction, because it seemed to me that the entire power structure referred to the whites who are in control of the area, who have set up District 9 and have now set up, it's going to be District 10, isn't it, to which they are moving the prawns. And in fact, all the real bile is not directed at Nigerians at all, but is directed at the authorities, who are uselessly attempting to move around this immigrant population that they don't know what to do with.
Is it time we said hello to Jason?
It is. Hello to Jason Isaacs.
Hello to David Morrissey.
Hello to David Morrissey.
And Stephen Fry. Assorted mentions of various people in Fairport Convention. In fact, all of them.
All of Fairport
past
Convention.
Past and present.
Yes.
Anyone else? I forget. I think we missed it out last year when you were in Lerwick. So we
last year?
Yeah, last year. Yeah, we haven't done anything since then.
Last year. Who it's else funny because it seems like just a week.
Michael Sheen, we always forget. So apologies to him. Hello to Michael Sheen.
And the Subways.
And everyone else who knows
us.
So what else is new?
Good Fish doctor? Tank.
Good. Anything else?
Can I do something about Fish Tank?
Let's talk about Fish Tank for a while.
Okay, so this is the new movie by Andrea Arnold, who won the Oscar for a short film, Wasp, and got up on the Oscar stage and famously said, "It's the dog's ahem," which, is the thing that will live with her forever. After that, made Red Road, which went to Cannes and won the jury prize. And unless I'm mistaken, I wasn't at Cannes this year, as you know. I think she won the jury prize again for Fish Tank. So it's the burden that she carries at the moment is that she's been hailed everywhere as the new Ken Loach, which is a very difficult thing. I think it's a hefty brush to tar anyone with, because being the new anyone is, it's hard. I also think it doesn't quite allow for the sort of the visual poetry of what she does. The story here is we have a teenage girl, Mia, who I think is meant to be about 15. She is effectively sort of emotionally introverted, but also, outgoingly violent. At the very beginning, we see her headbutt somebody. She's living at home with her mother and her sister, and along comes her mother's new boyfriend, played by Michael Fassbender, who, as you know, was the winner of the Kermode Award for Best Actor last year, and is a fantastic performer. And every time I see him in a different movie, it takes me about 30 seconds to realise it's him, because he is one of those genuinely mercurial performers who, every time you see him, he looks different, he holds himself different. It's like he kind of physically changes himself for each role. Anyway, she, Mia, is in need of emotional attention, emotional support. She spends her spare time learning how to do urban street dancing, but her mother doesn't seem to be giving her the support that she needs. It appears, however, that she may be getting some of that attention from the mother's new boyfriend. Here's a clip.
Get some clothes on, Mia.
I've got some clothes on.
You're half naked.
You don't normally care.
Yeah, well, I do now, so get dressed.
Why are you talking different?
Should we get a move on, yeah?
Where are you going?
I'm not going nowhere.
Well, why did you just say, shall we get a move on then?
Listen, we're only going for a drive.
You want to come?
No.
Both of you?
No, they won't want to
I
come.
Do.
But we're not going nowhere.
I don't care. I still want to come.
Off you go then, get dressed.
Thanks for that.
Now, inevitably, one thing leads to another, and the boundaries between, relationships between parents and children become blurred in a very sort of difficult and controversial way. Now, the important thing to say is this. I find Andrea Arnold's work very uncomfortable, and I don't know that that's a criticism of it. In the case of Red Road, I think that my criticism was that there was a central flaw in the plot, which I never quite got beyond, although I always felt that it had an atmosphere and a style that was peculiarly sort of intoxicating in a way which made me feel very awkward. There is some of that in Fish Tank, although Fish Tank doesn't have any of the plot problems. It negotiates, as all of her work does, very difficult areas of relationship. She seems to be to take a sort of non-judgmental stand on her characters, which is admirable. Her characters play their roles brilliantly. I mean, the person who's playing Mia is Katie Jarvis, who's a newcomer, is totally real. As I said, Michael Fassbender, I think, is always really, really good. And you do get a sense, therefore, that what you're watching is actually happening. Consequently, when what you're watching transgresses boundaries, it's all the more uncomfortable and all the more difficult. That is not to say that Fish Tank is a depressing or downbeat work. Far from it. It's very vibrant. It's full of life. The central character is, has a real vim and vigour, and you do absolutely believe in her. I still found it uncomfortable to watch, and I think I meant to have found it uncomfortable to watch. I have the feeling that at some point, a couple of features down the line, Andrea Arnold, who is clearly, clearly an enormous talent, is going to make a film that I get completely, and I'm suddenly going to look back on all the rest of the stuff and go, OK, fine, now I'm at ease with it. But I think that when that happens, I might lose something, because part of what is extraordinary about her work is it has a tactile quality, it has an uncomfortable quality, it has a it makes you feel that you're in the situation of the film, and I think that is something which is not entirely flagged up by saying she's the new Ken Loach, she's the new Mike Leigh. I mean, it, perhaps stylistically you refer maybe to Bresson or Lynn Ramsey, who incidentally I think has been making a new film and who I'm a really, really big fan of, Lynn Ramsey, but Andrea Arnold is doing something that's quite exceptional, and the fact that I never relaxed into her films, I'm increasingly thinking, is an indication of the validity of them.
Pig-based weaponry, meantime. Mike Preston in Cambridge. Bad guy called Iron Bar falls into a vat of pig waste in Mad Max 3.
And does he?
We didn't mention that.
Okay.
Martin Jackson in Cramlington, pig-based weaponry, string of presumably pork sausages used as nunchucks in Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Very good. That very good.
A band in the UK. Well, you don't know they're pork sausages, do you?
No. Well, they're sausages. But then again, the last time we mentioned this, there was an awful... There was a long email correspondence about whether it's that film or whether it's Toxic Avenger. But I think I'm pretty certain the pork sausages was in Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 1 or 2, but I stand to be corrected. It's one of those things I always get wrong.
The MC in Brighton, there is a fight with enormous hams in the Spanish film. Is it Jamon Jamon?
Jamon Jamon.
Jamon Jamon.
Yes. How are you?
If that is...
I speak English. If I learn it from a book.
A whole new accent. If that isn't pig-based weaponry, I don't know what is. It's exactly what he says. Rupert Fryer in Oxford, BA Honours, pending 2012. Dear Eric B. and Rakeem. I think I'll be Rakeem, actually.
OK.
Having just chucked in my job in North London, moving back to Oxford to attend university at the ripe old age of 27, this long-time podcaster can now enjoy listening live. I saw District 9 with a couple of mates last night, and while the multiplex experience was less than pleasant,
yeah,
I have to say thoroughly enjoyed the movie itself. My fiancé is, unfortunately, a Transformers-loving, Wolverine-enamoured blockbuster junkie, which means we tend not to attend the cinema as a couple. There may be problems ahead. Mm. But District 9 is a movie I'll be taking her to when I go back for a second viewing. While I can take a great interest in the obvious social commentaries and political undertones on show, she can sit back with her super-duper triple chocolate fudge toffee pecan ice cream and marvel at one huge explosion after another. It's truly a movie with something for everybody. Which is true. I mean, you judge it on one level. It is quite grimy and and disturbing, but it is kind of shoot the alien, a lot of alien splatter with political undertones.
It is, and I think, undertones and overcurrents. Yeah. Yes, it's a tsunami, really, isn't it? Isn't it?
Of?
I don't know, you were using water metaphors, and that was the only one that came to mind.
85058, mayo@bbc.co.uk. Any more pig-based weaponry, we'll mention this, will not be a long-running feature. It might finish at 4 o'clock today. Anyway, Nick Duncuff, and then back with what's going to be our next item?
Julie and Julia.
Thank you, I'll be Julie, and you can be Julia. Julia. Nick, what have you got?
I have an accident on the North... Nick Duncalf, Five Live Travel.
You can get Wittertainment updates throughout the week with the exciting, glorious edition of Dr. Mark, who has now learned how to Twitter from his phone.
I have.
So you go to twitter.com and you follow at Wittertainment. You can also go to twitter.com and follow at Simon May if you want show updates. You can get the podcast. It is available very, very soon after the programme.
OK.
You can subscribe via the website. I think that's it.
That's pretty much it, isn't it? Yeah. Or you could just shout.
That's the whole thing.
Yeah.
Or you could just turn up at reception and we'll say hello on our way out.
Yeah. Somebody gave me a DVD as I came into reception.
Why?
I don't know. I think it was the 9/11 Truth Committee people who, I have to say, I'm unconvinced by.
I bet you chucked it away, didn't you, straight away?
No, I was very polite. I said thank you very much.
And then you chucked it away. Okay, so out this week, Julie and Julia.
Yeah, which is the new film by Nora Ephron. And I like Nora Ephron. She comes in for a lot of shtick, She comes in for a lot of stick. A lot of shtick would be like, It's like that kind of shtick. Anyway, she comes in for a lot of
shtick. I love the Woody Allen, because you even look like him when you're doing the impression.
Thank you, because he had a quiff too. And it's the other thing which attracts me to it is, look, this is the poster for it, okay? okay? It's Julie and Julia, based on two true stories. You know how fondly I feel about anything which is based on a true story, inspired by real events, which is one of the phrases which I love. Inspired by real events means we totally made it up. But so this is based on two true stories. The true stories, which are recounted in two books. One is Julie and Julia by Julia Powell, who is the Julie of the title, and the other, My Life in France, by Julia Child. Now, when I say Julia Child, you think... Exactly, and therein lies the problem. Well done for doing that. There was a danger that you were going to actually know who Julia Child was. Apparently,
I was pretending.
Are you pretending?
Yeah.
No, fine. If you're acting. An American, Julia acting. If you're the acting darling, if you're an American, Julia Child is apparently the Fanny Craddock, you know, figure. She's the very sort of school marmly like Uber. Cookery figure who taught a nation to cook at a certain point. Now, the problem with this is that we have two performances. One of them is by Amy Adams, who I'm going to come to. Second one by Meryl Streep, okay? Muriel Strepsil. Apparently, Muriel is doing a spot-on impression of Julia Child in this clip, what you're about to hear. The problem, if you're English, is...
That.
Yeah, if you're British, if you're anything other than American, I shouldn't say English, I'm sorry, is who knows whether this is accurate. Put it this way, if it is accurate, then clearly Julia Child was a larger-than-life character. Here's a clip.
I'm probably the only American I know in Paris who thinks shopping for food is as much fun as buying a dress. Of course, you'd think so too if you lived in a country where absolutely nothing comes in my size. By the way, did you know that if you don't dry meat, it won't brown properly? Irma Rambauer doesn't say a word about it in The Joy of Cooking. Avis, I am in heaven here. I've been looking for a career all my life.
Happy Valentine's
and
Day.
And I found it.
You know what that sounds like? That sounds like a cartoon. That sounds like the exaggerated kind of voiceover you get in Toy Story.
I know, but shall I tell you what it also sounds like? It sounds like Lloyd Grossman doing an impression of Zooey Deschanel. Maybe which goes, you know, I can't get anything in my size. Who lives here? And yet she's doing the cookie figure. No, but that
enough.
Is... So, fine. If you know Julia Child, I'm sure you go, wow, it's incredible. Muriel has once again leapt brilliantly into the skin of another person. From my point of view, I think... It's, you know, it's a...
You think what?
I think... What exactly is that doing? She, you know, playing off against Stanley Tucci is absolutely brilliant, but... So there's a whole section going on which is in very broad strokes. Meanwhile, in the modern section, we have Amy Adams, who is the blogger who gets Julia Child's book and decides to make all the recipes in the space of a year. And the character that she plays in the movie, I don't know what she's like in real life because I didn't know anything about this story before, is incredibly wet. I mean, just incredibly wet. And I like Amy Adams very much, and she's a lot of things, and incredibly wet isn't one of them. But she is so wet that you could actually believe that Meg Ryan is a helicopter pilot. But just, you remember, that was always the yardstick before, Meg Ryan's helicopter pilot. No. Well, under these circumstances, yes. So, several problems. Don't know who the central character is. Not interested in the other character. Also, it is established at some point that there is a great frisson of tension between these two characters because it turns out that Julia Child doesn't actually have any respect or admiration for this young woman who is blogging and following in her footsteps and attempting to sort of bring her legacy back to life. But that's never explored. It's brought up and then it's kind of forgotten about. And the other thing is that what Nora Ephron does most perfectly, I mean, yeah, she worked with Woody Allen. She's a great screenwriter. And I think she's a better director than some people give her credit for. Like Richard Curtis, she is prone to allowing things to ramble much too long, and what she really needs is a good editor or a 90-minute time limit, and it may well have been that if the film was shorter, I would have felt more warmly towards it. But when she's really funny, she's really funny, but when she's baggy and sentimental, you know, the movie is really baggy and sentimental. And the problem with this was, it ended up being... I mean, my idea of a great food film is like grand bouffe, you know, it's something that's sort of slightly poisonous. And the problem with this is, it's like, you know, cooking and eating food, I don't care how many celebrity chefs we have on television, cooking and eating food is not a spectator sport. It's like chocolate, right, or chocolat, good to eat, not much fun to look at, to be honest with you. So much as I really wanted to, you know, to enjoy the smorgasbord of stuff that's going on there, I just kind of thought, well, you know, it's somebody doing a parody of a television cook that I don't know, or not television, a writing cook that I don't know, somebody else blogging who seems terribly wet and Amy Adams isn't really doing anything, and a frisson of tension between them, which is not explored and not going anywhere. And how long have I been here now?
About 8 years.
No, that's what I thought in the film. That was part of the review. I didn't suddenly stop the review and ask you how long I've been here.
Because the answer would be about 8 years.
About 8 years.
It's been a long time, isn't it? What else have we got? Because Dorian Gray. I was going to say, it's 5-4, and the people are thinking, well, where's Dorian
Gray? No, I'll do Dorian Gray next.
What's Dorian now? You haven't got much longer.
So I paid to go and see Dorian Gray because it opened on Wednesday, and so I went to see it yesterday in Southampton, in fact. And so latest update of a wild story by Oliver Parker, who's done many other wild adaptations, also did St. Trinian's, and is doing another St. Trinian's, apparently, unless there are two Oliver Parkers, which is, of course, entirely possible. And it stars as the central character, Ben Barnes, who's the guy from Narnia, but more importantly, Colin Firth as Lord Henry Wotton, who, of course, is the person who takes Dorian Gray and leads him into the path of depravity. Here is Colin Firth, who I love. I would watch Colin Firth reading the phone book, leading our young hero astray.
You're Kelso's grandson.
Yes.
Did you know him?
Met him once. It was enough to give a cheer last month when he rasped his last sour breath.
One assumes you inherited the withered old goat's estate. Being a little orphan isn't all bad. An earnest young man with a beautiful nature, according to Agatha. I pictured some freckled country oaf in ghastly dress. I see, I was only half right. It could be worse. Gladys Allenby's been dressed for her 14th birthday ever since her 40th. And if Radley spent a little less time in church and a little more at his tailor's, he might not so resemble a badly bound hymn book.
Now, I'm not sure.
Really?
But he sounds to me as though he's up to no good.
He's up to no good at all. And he's doing it in that Colin Firth way. I mean, I really like Colin Firth. I think when Colin Firth does rancid, decrepit characters or mad people, I think, you know, when he does something which is anti-heroic, he's actually much better. I mean, I think he's a great comic actor, and I understand that everybody fancies him because of that, you know, television thing in which he walked through the pond with his shirt off.
We've all done that.
We all had his shirt on.
It was just wet.
Okay, fine. But so here are the problems. The first one is that they've updated the script. They've moved it slightly forward in time, which is fine. They've put some additions into it, some of which fill out backstory, which I'm never really entirely happy with backstory. The main problem is this. Firstly, the portrait itself. You know, there's a 1945 version of the film with George Sanders in it, and the film is in black and white, but when you see the painting is in colour, right? And the painting, which starts off being beautiful, the idea is that the painting takes on all the decrepitude, the moral decrepitude, the ageing decrepitude of the central character, who then goes on to lead this, you know, sinful life, but not to decay in the flesh. So he becomes basically a devil's slave to his own beauty, yeah? But the portrait decays. I know everyone knows this, but I thought I should just mention it. Well, in the Sanders version, the portrait is brilliant. And the very first time after he's done the first bad thing, he comes back and he looks at the portrait and he's got a very slight sneer on its face. And then by the time we get to the end of it, it's turned into this kind of really kind of zombified, sort of putrescent, you know, mortifying thing. And I've seen that painting in real life because it's in Chicago. It's in a museum in Chicago. And I tell you, even in real life, you step in front of it, you go, in this version, the Colin Firth version, because, you know, Ben Barnes is the central character, but I'm referring to this as the Colin Firth version the same way as I'm referring to the other one, the George Sanders version, because the Wotton character is
enough
more interesting.
Enough subclauses.
Yes. They've done a CGI painting, so the painting moves and the painting three-dimensional maggots come out, and it's like, yeah, you know what? None of that is going to be as scary as the oil painting changing. And so the problem is the painting itself isn't menacing enough. The other problem is that the depravity into which Dorian Gray falls is terribly Arlene Phillips. He goes to all these sort of, you know, these dens of iniquity, in which there's an awful lot of choreographed depravity. There's an awful lot of that sort of
thing. So hot gossip stuff?
Yeah, it is all a little bit hot gossip.
Bruce Forsyth.
No, hot gossip. But also, it is, and I say this, it's a little bit Eyes Wide Shut. You know, it's like the orgy that Tom Cruise goes to in Eyes Wide Shut, in which he walks around with a mask on for a little bit, and while a piano goes bong, bing, bong, bing, and it's attempting to get the pop video generation. Apparently, it was slightly trimmed back in order to prevent it getting an 18 rating. So they've made a decision, I think it was the right decision, incidentally, to pull back more of the depravity to get it to a wider audience. Because in the end, its target audience is 14, 15-year-olds who like Ben Barnes and who may not know the story that intimately, but will at least be charmed by the kind of pop video aesthetic of it. And it's not bad. I mean, don't get me wrong.
Is he strong enough to hold the thing together, be the central character?
No, but Colin Firth is. I mean, Ben Barnes is a perfectly fine actor. I have nothing against him, but Colin Firth is the reason for me to go and see it. For everybody else, for the young people, for whom everything is still ahead of them, Ben Barnes is the reason to go and see it. But it is essentially a bit lightweight and a bit flimsy and a bit silly, and the portrait isn't scary enough.
So our movie of the week this week,
well, I think Fish Tank is the movie of the week, but the thing that I enjoyed most is Adventureland.
The podcast will be available. You can follow updates and adventures at Wittertainment if you do that Twitter thing. Thanks very much indeed for listening. It's The Mighty Drive coming next. Have a great weekend, back on Monday at 1 o'clock.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
Hello, me again. To watch my latest reviews, take a trip to www.bbc.co.uk/Mark Kermode for the Kermode Uncut blog.